Hey, it's Flaves, and this is Climate Changers, a podcast where we celebrate the heroes who are on the front lines of creating a new and sustainable resource and energy economy. Today, my guest is Justin Gillis, an award-winning journalist and author of the upcoming book, The Big Fix, Seven Practical Steps to Save Our Planet. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So in your new book, you've outlined seven practical changes we can all make for maximum impact. What are they?
They're going to sound like things that people would have a hard time doing on their own when I run through them with you. But that is the magic of the book, is we show you in the book how to make these changes. What we need to do if we're going to not wreck the planet is we need to clean up the electric grid. That's sort of step number one. We have to clean up our transportation system. You've probably, and your listeners have probably heard a lot about electric cars. That's a step in the right direction. We've got to clean up our buildings, which now, you know, still to this day, burn a lot of fossil fuels and throw a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We have to clean up our industry, and that includes things like making steel, making cement, making chemicals, making plastics. Part of this agenda is we have to stop building stupid cities and start building better cities. Boulder, Colorado leaps to mind as a really good example. We need to clean up our food system and the way we use land. And then the seventh step is one we call invent the future, which basically means supporting development of new technologies that we're going to need to sort of, you know, work our way through this massive global cleanup over the coming decades. So I said those would sound hard, and of course they are hard. But what we do in the book is we do our best to convince people that these things are tractable, and we specifically show them how. And the way we do that is by showing these levers in the economy that a lot of people don't really know about. Almost all of them under the control of the government in one way or another. Most people don't realize, for example, that a board in their state, essentially a fancy committee, essentially has complete control of the electricity system and can decide whether we're going to build clean power plants or dirty power plants. And that board is charged by law with listening to the public and taking the public's opinions into account. So that's a long answer to your question, but this is the kind of plan of the book, is to go through all these sectors and then try to get people past this feeling of fear and disempowerment and show them that they can make a difference on some of these things if they spend a little time at it.
That's incredibly interesting. So could you talk a little bit more about where these decisions about where and how we supply our energy from is made and who decides?
It varies, of course, by the economic sector that we're talking about. And this is a lot of what people need to understand. I mean, this is sort of the point of the book, is kind of laying out, you know, the decision geography, if you would, of a lot of these issues. You might think that sort of the free market, quote unquote, is deciding, you know, how we use energy, where we get energy, whether it's dirty or clean energy. And really, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, these decisions are heavily under the influence of governments, and they always have been. Take oil, for example. You know, oil appears to be a market, like the price is set in a market, right? And you can sort of read every day about the price of oil. But how much oil we're pumping is a decision being made by governments, right? You know, by Saudi Arabia, by Venezuela, by Russia. So those countries are really deciding the price of oil sort of in conjunction with the market. Similarly, and closer to home, the committees that I mentioned, which are called public utility commissions or public service commissions, depending on the state, they directly control the electricity grid and the electricity system and tell the utilities what they're allowed to build and then set the prices at which they can recover their costs by charging the public. Here's another example that people are not aware of. Depending on what state you live in, you may have noticed that your state either does or does not have a lot of electric cars on the market right now. In some states, you go try to buy one and you can barely find them, right? That's not random at all. That's being decided on the basis of whether a particular state has embraced California's emission standards, which states are allowed to do under federal law. They're allowed to do that. And if they do that, that compels the car makers to put a whole bunch more clean cars on the market in those states. So literally what kind of car you can buy is being decided in part by decisions that your state government makes. In some states, that decision could even be made by the governor. It doesn't have to be made by the legislature. So there's a whole bunch of these things out there, like these kind of, we call them secret levers, and they're secret only in the sense that people don't know about them and haven't informed themselves, but they're there. And our task is to figure out where they are and pull them.
So Justin, I've cheated and I've read some excerpts from your new book, even though it's not out yet. And you talk a lot about the political economy. Does this part of the economy fall under that umbrella of political economy? And what is it and how does it work?
Political economy is kind of an old term that I think is coming back, and I'm glad that it's coming back. Economists once understood, and you know, the entire discipline was once called political economy because it was understood by everybody that how the economy works depends heavily on sort of decisions made by the government. Whether you even have a quote-unquote free market depends on rules set up by the government, right? You know, the very existence of capitalism, it came into existence because of legal changes that made it possible to amass large amounts of money and, you know, things like the grant of limited liability to corporations and so forth. So the point is, the economy is heavily dependent on the kind of legal infrastructure set up by the government. And so what we're trying to make people aware of here is that in our energy system in particular, there is a whole lot of government hand or handiwork, you might say, deciding what choices are available to us, what's getting built, how fast it's getting built, what can get approved or not get approved, whether that power line is going to go in or not, whether that new wind farm is going to go in or not. These are all decisions that are, they're not pure economic decisions. They are in substantial part political decisions. And so our discussion of the term political economy is an attempt to, it's part of the attempt to help people understand that and to realize that we're in a democracy and their voices in this democracy can make a real difference in how fast we clean up the energy system.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, this system can be difficult for an ordinary citizen to navigate. Who benefits the most when the public stays silent?
I bet your listeners would be surprised to learn that in most states, many states, and I think I'm correct to say most of them, the leading contributor, the single industry that is the leading contributor to state politicians is the electricity system, the utilities. You know, what do they want? They want price increases, right, to be approved by these boards I've been talking about, the public utility commissions. They want the legislature to pass laws favorable to them that sort of tell the public utility commissions how to operate and so on and so forth. And so they rig the system by dumping huge amounts of money in it. That's not all they do. They take both the utility commissioners and a lot of legislatures on things like free hunting trips, put them up in nice hotels. Sometimes there's absolute corruption. There's a $50 million utility bribery scandal going on in Ohio right now. You may be aware that the Speaker of the Illinois House was forced out fairly recently in another huge, you know, kind of pay-to-play, you know, effectively a bribery scandal. And so, you know, when the public is silent, you know, the people with an interest take over, the fossil fuel companies take over, right? And that's really a big part of the story of our economy and why we're not moving faster toward clean energy is these decisions have been captured by the fossil interests. And the only counter for that is the public speaking up in the public interest.
But when we think about the public, especially with people who are concerned about climate, a lot of people are demotivated because they feel like it's too late and they don't have a voice. What do you tell people who think it's already too late?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of this again was the primary motivation for the book is so many people out there just feel completely, as you said, demotivated, or I sometimes say disempowered. I've in my career spoken on a lot of college campuses, and invariably in the Q&A session, somebody would stand up and say something like, this problem is so large and I am so small. What can I possibly do about it? And our answer to that, a lot of people have sort of settled on, okay, I can't do much, but I'm going to do what I can. So I'm going to do a better job of recycling. I'm going to cut down on my consumption of meat. I'm going to, you know, turn off the lights after I leave the bathroom. You know, I'm going to change out my light bulbs for LED bulbs. These are all really good things to do, by the way, but by themselves, they are not enough, because this is a massive, massive system that needs to be changed. And, you know, with so much of it, you know, when you flip on a light switch, you're not making any decision about how that power gets generated, right? So people need to understand that they have to, we have to transition from being green consumers, which is where I think a lot of people are right now, to being green citizens. What does that mean? It means, first and foremost, letting this issue of climate change, clean energy, and so forth be a huge influence on how you vote. You know, I would say that's the first and most basic step that people should take. And by the way, Republican voters need to do that as well as Democrats. In fact, the Democratic Party is now like, you know, the single party that's really on this issue. We desperately need Republican voters asking their politicians what they're going to do to support clean energy. And then beyond just voting, we need political engagement. It doesn't have to take over your life, right? Somebody's life. It doesn't have to become the only thing you do. It can be something you do once or twice a year, but it does need to be a little more sophisticated than, you know, write an email to your congressman, right? We're trying to get people beyond that into the rooms where some of these decisions are being made and have them speak up again in defense of the broad public interest. It's the only way we can counter the takeover of the system by the fossil companies and so forth.
And what are some examples of community action that you find impressive?
So in the book, we have an example that comes from your state of Colorado. If you remember a few years ago, the power company there, Xcel, which has actually been quite good compared to most of the power companies on these issues, they proposed a clean energy plan. And you would think, sort of miracle of miracles, if the power company comes in and proposes it, it's just going to sail right through, right? Well, that plan had opposition. It had opposition from Republicans in the state legislature. It had a lot of opposition from some of the cooperatives in Colorado, some of the smaller utility companies that still burn coal. Basically, anybody, you know, with a big investment in coal was opposed to Xcel's plan. And so there needed to be a public push to help sort of get it over the finish line. And I went to a meeting on a freezing night, I think it was in February in downtown Denver, and watched a bunch of mothers, many of them with three-month-old babies on their hips or six-month-old babies on their hips, walk up to the microphone and say, I'm for this plan. I want clean air for my baby to breathe. So it wasn't for them only about climate change. I mean, there's a convergence of issues here where cleaning up the electricity system on the grounds of climate will also get us cleaner air. And as you know, we have a huge childhood asthma problem in this country, just sort of rising rates of asthma and childhood onset of asthma. So, you know, I watched that play out in Colorado. That's a really good example. There are other examples around the country. We put in the book two sisters, the Clemens Cope sisters from, I believe, Rockville, Maryland, who, with a bunch of other local activists, went and badgered their school board and said, what are you going to do? You know, you all say you're for action on global warming, but you haven't really done anything. You know, there's a lot of cities and, you know, school boards and such out there talking about it and not really doing much. And so, you know, there was a big activist campaign, and that school board finally committed to changing out their entire fleet of school buses over to electric buses. And now it'll take a few years to do that, but they have taken the vote and they are going to do it. I don't understand why every parent in America who's sending a kid to school on a bus doesn't wake up and realize my kid is riding to school on a dirty diesel bus with, you know, in the summer when the windows are open, fumes blowing into the kids' faces, right? Why is that still happening? And why aren't parents going down to school board saying, excuse me, when are you going to have a plan? So this is the kind of thing that needs to happen. And decisions are being made every day in cities and counties across this country to perpetuate the fossil fuel economy. We need to get in their faces, in the faces of those politicians, and tell them, stop, do it a different way.
And as citizens become more active, what challenges should individuals and communities expect to face when they're working to lower greenhouse gas emissions?
I think maybe the biggest challenge is just that this is going to be slow, right? And, you know, we're behind the curve. We're starting 30 years too late. We have made some progress. You know, electricity emissions in the United States have fallen. Overall emissions in the United States have fallen. Emissions from vehicles, cars, are still rising, by the way. That's our biggest problem right now. People just have to realize we are in this for the long haul. This is a slog, and we're going to be working on it for the rest of our lives. None of us alive today, maybe the very youngest people, maybe kids being born today will live to see a completely decarbonized, carbon-free energy system. But, you know, I'm 62, so I'm not going to live to see that. And you got to just brace yourself for the long haul and realize the progress is going to be slow and incremental. I think one of the biggest problems is how we're continually disappointed by Washington, right? We work our tails off in the elections to get the right people in. And then, you know, I mean, the Democratic Party is, you know, the only game in town on climate right now, but it's a bit feckless and doesn't push this issue as hard as it should. And so we all get upset, I think, when things don't go right in Washington. But to me, that just means turn to your state and local government. For the time that Washington is paralyzed, let's work on it where we can work on it. And, you know, a lot of progress can be made at sort of state and local levels. That's where we need to put our attention right now, I think.
What are a few ideas of things that my listeners can do now?
Well, people need to inform themselves of what's going on in their state and in their town. That obviously means reading the news and just sort of paying attention to clean energy issues and climate issues that are coming up. But also, I think it's a good idea to figure out what groups are active in your state. And that really varies state by state. You know, it's not possible to give a master list in the time we have. People have to do a little digging. There are national groups that do a lot of work across the country and may very well be active in your state, such as the Sierra Club. There's almost always, in any state where these issues are being fought over, which is the majority of them now, there's almost always a mailing list of some kind that can keep people informed about issues. There are mailing lists that can keep you informed when issues are coming up before the Public Utilities Commission in your state or the Public Service Commission. People need to start following that stuff and be prepared to act. It's actually become a lot easier. You know, part of what happened in the pandemic is everybody went to online meetings for even these really important meetings like PUC hearings and so forth. So now if you want to testify, you don't even have to go down to the state capitol necessarily. You can sign up to do that, you know, by video feed. And you know, then there's also a lot of opportunities at the local level, too. And it just requires a little digging to figure out. But every year, if you live in a city of any size, that city every year is buying new cars for their workers, for example. They have a fleet and it has a turnover year by year. Well, they're most likely still buying gasoline-burning cars. Go ask them why, right? So I think the big trick is finding other people who care. It might be as simple as a post on your Facebook feed or your Nextdoor feed, right? And ask who else is involved. Because we got to do this, you know, we got to hook up into groups and into coalitions. Like, it really is too big for any of us to do it alone. So we need to find other people and go at them as a group.
And let's talk a little bit more about your new book, The Big Fix. Outside of the practical but ambitious examples you've given so far, what else can your readers expect to find in the book?
We do give examples where there are direct actions that people can take. We advocate that people look hard when their furnace comes up for replacement or is about to wear out. We want people to look very hard at switching out a gas-burning furnace for a device called a heat pump. And I quote, a lot of people don't even know what a heat pump is. I quote somebody in my book describing it as a bisexual air conditioner. It goes both ways. So it's really, you know, a device that can either heat or cool your house, depending on which way it's running, right? And a whole lot of heating that's being done out there right now with gas could be done with heat pumps, which are super, super efficient. And a lot of people from 20, 30 years ago have a bad taste about heat pumps. They weren't so great back then. They've gotten much, much better. And we think the time is ripe for people to take a second look at that, particularly right now with the very high gas prices. So The point is, in the book, people will find examples of things they can do in their own lives as consumers, but also things where they can join up with others and take political action. We really think that we need both.
So, Justin, what makes you optimistic about the future?
I guess the thing that makes me optimistic is that this has become a sort of youth movement, right? We now have, I mean, I was in despair, you know, 15 years ago when I kind of started on this subject, because in the United States, there was almost no real political movement over climate. As time has gone on, I think people have begun to see with their own eyes, you know, a lot of the climate denialism has faded. Lots of people, including lots of older people now, are saying, boy, this is not the weather I grew up with. You know, it did not get to 115 degrees, you know, in Portland, Oregon, you know, in the weather, in the climate I grew up in. And, you know, now that started to happen. It started to get to, you know, it's approaching 120, you know, for days and days on end in parts of India and Pakistan. You know, there are places that are just becoming unlivable as we speak. So people are seeing it. People are starting to wonder, what can we do? And so we've seen this rise of a youth movement, which makes complete sense. I mean, they're the people that have the most stake in this, right? You know, us older people are going to be off the stage by the time the worst happens. But the, you know, the people that are kids today are, you know, inheriting the wind here, or inheriting the heat, I guess. So that makes me hopeful, but I would say that we still do not have the level of engagement, the level of political demand that we need. I mean, the fossil fuel interests are still really intractable. They're using the current situation and the high gas prices, for example, to push the sort of drill, baby, drill agenda and essentially exploiting the Ukraine war for their own purposes. So we have a fight on our hands, and we need more troops on the field, let's say, on the right side of this issue.
Well, Justin, thank you for helping us all understand how we can have a meaningful impact on greenhouse gas emissions. And thank you for joining this episode of Climate Changers.
Absolutely. And I'll just take the opportunity to tell people the book is out September the 20th, and it's called The Big Fix. You can buy it in any bookstore, so I hope they will.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Every episode of Climate Changers has a call to action posted in the show notes. Each call to action has been curated to make it easy for you to help create the changes that we discussed today. Thank you for joining Climate Changers. Until next time.